nervously. "Of course," I agreed. But deep down, I didn't believe Ansys would bend under pressure. "For now, we need only concern ourselves with the first step. Matthew, you and Gary, along with Moira and Graham, will go to Cantley. There, you..."
"Hold up," protested Matthew. "I don't need that many people."
I shook my head. "You need Gary to pin down the location of the village. He can detect their shorter-range signals. You'll need Moira to examine any ungol that you find, to make certain they're beyond help before you do anything final."
"And Graham?" asked my son.
"To make sure nothing kills either of you. You and Moira both are a little reckless," I finished. Matt grunted. "Coming from you, that doesn't mean much." That earned him a laugh. Then I went on. "Meanwhile, I'll go to where Lancaster used to be and turn it into a slag pit."
"And who are you taking with you?" countered my son.
"No one," I stated. "I can walk in unopposed, just as I did when I found Elaine. When I start, it won't be safe for anyone near me."
"That doesn't make any sense," began Matthew.
"Too bad. I'm in charge," I said, overriding his argument. "In case of reprisals, we'll have Irene stay here with your mother. Connell can go and warn the Queen. He can help protect her as well."
"What about George?"
"I didn't expect you'd get a signal this soon. I already sent him to Gododdin on a separate matter," I answered. Matthew nodded, his face a mask as he thought through my last statement.
"This is a surprise attack. How likely do you think it is that they'll be able to manage a reprisal before we can get back?"
I glanced at Gary. After a second, the android spoke.
"Ansys has already made one attempt to infiltrate this place. Clearly they know its location. There's a high probability they have other assets in place somewhere, but we have no way of knowing what or where."
"Then maybe we should wait until we can make sure..."
"They grow by the day, by the minute," I interrupted. "The sooner we strike, the better. If that flushes their hidden forces out into the open, then so much the better."
Gary agreed.
"This is true. How soon, though?"
"Now," I told them.
Several hours later, I was walking down the road that led to what had once been Lancaster. Flying would have been much faster, but Matthew and Moira would need more time. Though they could take the world road to Cantley, they'd have to fly on Dragonback from there. Then they'd need to actually find their target. All in all, their mission was more complicated than mine. They had to find the Ungol village and then determine whether to destroy it or to attempt to liberate its inhabitants before destroying the area. Moira's gifts would be particularly useful for that task. My job was comparatively simple. Lancaster was gone. I could do my work without worrying about any loss of innocence other than the trees and strange wildlife. The moon was just a sliver in the sky, casting barely any usable light, but I didn't need much. I didn't have dragon-enhanced eyesight, since I'd never bonded with any of the dragons, but a simple spell accomplished the same benefit. Mage sight alone was more than enough to walk a country road at night, but by enhancing my eyesight, I was able to enjoy the quiet scenery. The land sloped gently downward toward the Glenmay River on my left, while the forest sat dark and brooding on my right as I advanced toward my destination. This was the same road my birth mother had once taken, trying to escape assassins with me in her arms. It was the same road where I'd once killed thousands of Gododdin troops before drowning their remnants in the valley. It seemed fitting I would walk it as I headed toward my next act of carnage. At least this time I wouldn't be killing human beings. It was also beautiful. The land was a vast canvas of varying shades of grey as the grass rippled beneath the faint moonlight. Replete with silence, I walked through the night. Sometime after midnight, I reached the edge of the primeval forest that had replaced Lancaster. Gone was the gentle land of my childhood, replaced by the oppressive presence of arboreal giants. It would take a few more hours to reach the center, but I had no doubts about what I would do there. Danger was my companion now, and I knew from our first disastrous journey that mage sight alone wouldn't be enough to forewarn me of some of the perils in this place. Softly, I relaxed, letting myself fall gently into the state I called the mind of the stone. My existence expanded slightly, the border between self and the other becoming something that extended 20 yards beyond my quaint human body. My emotions died, replaced by a crystalline clarity. But while all within me was still, there was movement beyond, things creeping, crawling, and flying, both beyond and inside me. That wouldn't do. Only one thing was allowed to move, the small bit of human flesh at my center. With that decision, I changed,
and the sphere of influence that was now me became a malevolent being, inimical to anything that displayed motive force. Insects were torn apart, worms smothered by the soil that was their home, birds fell dead as the very air strangled them. Larger beasts were caught by vines and impaled by branches on trees that suddenly became animated. I walked, and death walked with me. The world changed around me, progressing in a single direction, as though I was merely a boat floating in a gentle current of indifferent violence. The earth hummed and the sky vibrated, singing to me, whispering dreams of something greater, tempting me to join them. But I retained enough awareness to avoid that folly. Another voice sang with them, a deep counterpoint to the dazzling brilliance of the living earth, the empty call of the void. It was a wonder I hadn't noticed it when I was younger, for it seemed painfully evident to me now. It lay in the silence between sounds, the rest between heartbeats, the cold that hovered outside the warmth of living bodies. It was in the space between the tiniest particles of earth and air, and it knew me. It begged for my attention. But I ignored it, training my awareness to stay with the voice of the earth and air. The void had seen me before, and if I let myself look back at it, it would take me again. Yet still I was tempted. If my desire was to kill anything that came within my sphere of influence, the void was far easier. Why crush, tear, and smother when life could more simply be devoured? And then I was there, in the center of it all, and I came to rest. I'd encountered any number of massive creatures by then, and left them broken and mangled in my wake. Now that I was no longer moving, more of them came to me. Spiders, wolves, massive bears, and things I had no name for all came, and just as quickly died. Deep beneath me, the earth lay eager, waiting to be released, but it wasn't time yet. I had to wait for the signal. What signal? A light, I said tonelessly, reminding myself as I exercised an almost forgotten human throat. There was something new in the darkness. Things that moved without life, constructions of metal that were more akin to the void than the earth. I'd expected them, but this was when things would become dangerous. These things could destroy me from a distance. Letting my body expand farther, I called to the earth, and it answered, sending great slabs of stone upward to join me, building a huge mass of stone around the fragile flesh at my center. Almost as soon as it was done, parts of me disintegrated, collapsing under the assault of powerful hammer blows. The enemy was bombarding me. Within seconds, I knew I was far from safe, so I drew more stone, encasing myself in a small granite mountain. I was large enough now that I could heal almost any damage to my exterior as quickly as it could be done to me. But there was a problem. I couldn't see the sky. I need to see the light when it comes. Before I could do anything about that, however, something ripped through the stone surrounding me, penetrating deeply. More attacks struck the same place, shattering the outer layer of my defense and driving ever closer to my vulnerable center. The damage was unrelenting. I had to grow larger or eliminate the threat, otherwise I wouldn't last long enough to see a signal. They already know I'm here. No point in holding back. With a sigh, I released my tenuous hold on humanity and reached down, deep into the earth. It had been waiting, like a hungry hound anxious for its master's call. I changed. My viewpoint grew, and the world became simpler. My blood boiled beneath the cold crust of my skin, and I found joy in giving it release. I brought it up from the depths, letting it spill across the land, swallowing the insignificant metal parasites that had been pelting me. The ground, no. I rose up, hot and molten, and everything burned, melted, or turned to ash. The fire, my anger, grew ever larger, expanding like ripples on a pond, consuming everything around it. Hotter I burned and farther I spread. The forest was gone, and I began to devour the land beyond that. But as I grew, I felt my anger and my will begin to cool. My awareness was fading, my anger melting away. Why had I come? And then I saw it. The sky flashed, a brilliant light in the distance that illuminated the world briefly. The signal. Somehow I knew what it meant. It was over. I had to return. Slowly, painfully, I forced myself to contract, to become small once more.
It wasn't easy, but I knew what I needed to be. I'd been it before. I would be it again. Flesh forgets, but the stone remembers, even if the stone must become flesh. Eventually, I found myself standing high above the Glenmay Valley, a mountain of burning rock beneath my feet. I'd protected myself from the heat, though I couldn't remember doing so. The sky was beginning to brighten in the east, the first sign of dawn approaching, and I had no idea how long I'd been standing there. I felt heavy, as though my arms and legs were bound with iron weights. I was tired. Surrounded by burning clouds of smoke and ash, I descended, using magic to assist when there was no good footing to be found. After a while, a thought occurred to me. This is stupid. I should be flying. And so I did, grasping the air with my will and letting it send me in the direction I needed to go. Home. Chapter 35. Penny wasn't happy. Actually, that was an understatement. She'd been in a good mood earlier, but that had been shattered when Mort had showed up late for dinner and begun issuing orders with the frenetic passion of a madman. Or as I like to think of it, the frenetic passion of my husband. He'd always been like this. It was like being married to two different men. One calm, quiet, somewhat lazy, and introspective to the point of being almost melancholic. The other was the demon that had shown up tonight. Mordecai could dither, debate, and ponder for ages, but when he made up his mind on something, he turned into an altogether different creature. The quiet philosopher had vanished, and the frenzied madman had appeared. Worse, this time it wasn't the usual one, the madman who locked himself in his workshop for days on end, pursuing strange projects. No, this one was telling everyone to prepare for war. He'd issued orders like a battlefield commander, with no patience for debate or dissension. She'd put up with such from him in the past, but usually it had been at times when it seemed warranted. Today, there had been no warning, no foreshadowing, no anticipation of chaos or disaster. They had had some shocks recently, including the unexpected attack by the Ungol, but Penny hadn't expected to be rushing about tonight, preparing for unseen enemies. No, she'd expected a warm cup of tea, some conversation, and some snuggling with Humphrey. As if he could read her mind, the half-grown puppy beside her began barking again. Humphrey had picked up on the excitement immediately, and he'd been dashing about and occasionally jumping, tongue out, ever since Mort had destroyed the evening's peace. "Hush!" she snapped at the dog. Humphrey yelped, and then ran to jump around Alyssa, still hoping to be included in whatever game all the humans were up to. Frowning, Penny scratched ineffectively at her stump. She was clad once more in a heavy gambeson with her enchanted mail over it. Both had been mended and altered to eliminate the unnecessary left sleeve, but it still itched. Her only solace was that she'd had it washed before being altered, so for once the smell wasn't as bad as usual. Unfortunately, the new armor that Mordecai had been talking about for the past week still wasn't ready, and neither was the arm he'd been crafting. It was supposed to be a surprise, but she hadn't had much trouble figuring it out. Clever as he was, Mort was an open book to her.
"Shouldn't we be staying here?"
asked Alyssa for perhaps the second time.
"It's probably safer."
"This place is no longer a secret, as well you know," answered Penny harshly, causing Alyssa to lower her eyes.
Less than a year ago, the younger woman had led enemies to their hidden mountain home to kidnap Irene. She had been largely vindicated of her crime, but her service to the Illinial family was part of the punishment that had been handed down to her. Penny liked the girl, and ordinarily she wouldn't have snapped at her, but the stress was making her feel waspish. She didn't apologize, but she softened her tone for the next remark.
"Besides, Irene is the only wizard left, and she needs to be in the keep in order to operate the castle defenses if there really is an attack. If my daughter is there, then I will be there."
Less than an hour later, they were ensconced in the family quarters within the keep, a place they almost never really slept. Lady Rose and Elise were with them, seeming determined to keep some sort of all-night vigil. The castle guard had been notified, and at least half the men were on duty, patrolling the walls and taking defensive stations throughout the castle. The town gates were closed, as was the castle gate. Even the portcullis had been lowered. Rose looked at her over the rim of her latest cup of tea.
"Do you really intend to wear that all night, dear?"
She was referring to Penny's mail, of course. Mort's mother answered before she could respond herself.
"Of course she does," said Meredith supportively. My daughter takes her duty very seriously.
Meredith, being a commoner by birth and upbringing, had very different views on the matter than Lady Rose. As mothers-in-law went, Penny couldn't say she always agreed with Meredith either, but the woman was always in her corner, right or wrong.
I didn't mean to sound critical, Meredith, said Rose placatingly. I just worry she won't be able to rest.
It isn't as if any of us will be sleeping tonight anyway, said Meredith snippily. Not until the children get back.
By children, Meredith was referring to the fact that with the exception of Irene, all her grandchildren, along with Graham, were elsewhere, facing who knew what sort of danger. Penny found herself smiling faintly.
Actually, she's probably referring to Mort too, she thought.
Meredith Eldridge was only slightly more protective of her grandchildren than she was her son.
You make an excellent point, Meredith, said Elise, chiming in. None of us will rest easy tonight.
Rose actually agreed with them, but her irritation had made her argumentative. It was a sign of her inner turmoil that she'd put herself in a position to be verbally outmaneuvered to begin with. Rather than argue, she gave a small nod and took another sip of her tea.
I still think it would be better for me to be with Irene, muttered Penny.
Her daughter was spending the night in the control chamber in order to respond if there was an actual attack.
If anything happens, you're only a couple of flights of stairs and a short run from her side, said Elise. Besides, Elissa is with her. The girl is a formidable warrior, observed Rose. That was certainly true, thought Penny.
In fact, without armor and a sword in her hand, she wasn't entirely sure she could defeat the young woman if she had to. Elissa had been trained in the same style of combat as Cyan and Graham. Though she didn't have a dragon bond, the woman fought with almost supernatural skill. It was ironic that Irene's one-time kidnapper was now her bodyguard.
Besides, continued Rose, the most probable outcome for tonight is that we will all lose sleep for nothing. In my experience, nothing ever happens when we expect it. Bad things always happen when you're relaxed and feeling secure.
By the time she finished her remark, she realized how dark it sounded.
My apologies, I didn't mean to sound morbid.
Elise grinned wickedly at Rose while waving one hand at Penny.
My daughter-in-law is just as anxious and miserable as our armored countess here.
Then she turned to Meredith.
Would you like some wine? I don't think tea is going to be sufficient for this evening.
Penny gaped at the two old women.
You would drink when there may be an impending attack.
Meredith laughed.
I'm 18 now. What would I do if there was an attack? I'd rather be useless and tipsy than useless and cranky.
Then she smiled.
Thank you, Elise. I think I could stand to have a glass.
Penny hadn't expected to fall asleep, but when her eyes flew open, she realized she must have. Her eyes darted around, finding Rose sitting upright across from her, alarm on her features.
What is it?
Said Penny, unsure of what had awakened her. Both of them were on their feet, rushing toward the window, when a boom so deep it was more felt than heard shook them.
I think that's what woke us, offered Rose. They looked out the window in time to see the outer wall of the castle collapse.
Then they felt the floor shake beneath them.
Take them to the cottage,
yelled Penny, running for the door. By them, she was referring to Elise and Meredith, who'd retired earlier. To reach the mountain cottage, they merely needed to leave the apartment and return by the same door, activating the portal. That hadn't been the plan, of course, but Penny's feet had already communicated the fact that the castle was far from safe. Rose, ever quick to react, was already hurrying to fetch the two elderly women. Penny ran down the castle hallway, her feet driving her so quickly that she was forced to run two steps up the wall when she reached the end and had to turn. Then she was in the stairwell. Ignoring the steps, she took each flight in a single bound. The observer at the back of her mind commented dryly,
You're going to regret that tomorrow when your body figures out what you've done.
She ignored the thought, for now she felt nothing. She was almost to the bottom floor when the wall to her right exploded into a cloud of dust. Stone shards ripped through the air and she felt a stinging pain on her face. Then the walls above began to slide down, sagging now that their support was gone. Stumbling, she made her way through the rubble, moving as quickly as possible, for it seemed the entire stairway might soon collapse. She emerged into a hallway that was now less of a corridor than it was a bizarrely designed, partially enclosed room. The wall on one side had fallen, and large sections of the ceiling were now part of a floor that was half buried by stone blocks, wood planks, and broken support timbers. People stumbled through the dust, crying and yelling, lost in the chaos. Penny added her own voice, yelling for all she was worth, Irene! She could see the control chamber now, though it had been hidden. One of the walls had fallen away, leaving it exposed. There was no one within, though she ran to it anyway to make certain her daughter wasn't trapped beneath something. It was empty. A blue light stood out, glowing on the central pedestal.
She activated the shield,
Penny realized.
But where is she now?
Another thudding boom sounded, and Penny saw one of the castle servers vanish as a stone wall behind him disintegrated. People were screaming from all sides. Penny knew she needed to take charge, but it was impossible. She needed to know where the enemy was, where safety was, and where her people were.
She knew none of that. Castle Cameron was coming down around her. Outside, I have to be able to see.
But fear for her daughter stopped her.
Where was Irene? Then she heard men yelling from what she thought must be the castle yard. A strange high-pitched whine grew and then became a roar. The yells of her guardsmen turned into screams. With no better options, Penny ran toward their cries, leaping over broken stone and piles of timber. Seconds later, she found herself outside the walls of the keep, staring at a scene from a nightmare. Guardsmen lay everywhere, some moaning and others simply dead. The bailey was still intact, the gates closed, but the east wall on one side of it was largely gone. The shield barrier, normally invisible to ordinary eyes, flashed periodically as something powerful assaulted it. But the worst was inside already. Two large metal monstrosities stood in the center of the yard. Each stood on three metal legs, and while they didn't appear to have heads, they each had two menacing arms. The roaring noise came from these. One arm on each of them was a blur, as though it was spinning while spitting flashes of light. Their torsos rotated slowly in a circle as they targeted the remaining guards who were trying to find safe cover. Most were already down. Penny had never seen such things before, but she knew of them from Moira's story of the battle outside of Dunbar. She even had a name for them, from Matthew's journey to Karen's world. Tortoise. Strictly speaking, they weren't alive. They were military machines designed for one purpose. One of them was strafing the inside of the walls, but the other was firing more deliberately on an unmoving target. Penny's eyes followed, and she spotted two figures huddled against one of the surviving walls of the main keep, Irene and Alyssa. Light and sparks flashed around them, and her daughter had a look of furious intensity as she focused on whatever it was that protected them. People often ascribe emotions or thoughts to such moments of stress or danger, but the truth is both simpler and more complicated. The body acts so quickly that the conscious mind of thought and experience is left behind, merely a witness to the subliminal decisions of the heart. They analyze their actions afterward, within seconds, giving words and meanings to their doings, but the reality of such moments is immediate and without verbal description. Penny flew across the courtyard at a speed that would have been impossible if she'd consciously attempted it. Simply thinking of it would have made the coordination required unattainable. But Penny didn't think. She launched herself, a missile of flesh and blood, across the intervening space between her and the thing attacking her youngest child. At the end, she leapt, turning her body cat-like in the air to land feet first against the tortoise's metal torso, while simultaneously driving her sword point first into the whirling blur of its weapon. The hilt was wrenched from her grasp as the machine's weapon exploded into deadly fragments of steel and fire. Penny was sliding downward, for there was nowhere to stand. She scrabbled for purchase with both her living arm and the phantom arm that her body continually forgot was gone. Her right hand caught the tortoise's second arm, the one bearing what she'd been told was the machine's heavier weapon. Still sliding down, she gripped the other weapon fiercely, her legs flailing beneath her. The large, box-like weapon was beginning to hum as it charged up, its torso rotating to bring it in line with Irene and Alyssa. The movement brought Penny's legs into contact with one of the thing's three legs, and without thinking, she wrapped her own around it. Using her arms and legs, her slender body strained to arrest its motion, to keep the point from lining up with her daughter. Despite her awkward leverage, for a second she achieved a stalemate. Her muscles were taut, and somewhere deep in her chest she felt a pop, followed by searing pain. The tortoise began to move again, slowly, but Penny continued to struggle. And then the second tortoise opened fire again, not at the wall this time, but at the woman struggling with its complement. Penny's world flashed red as hammer blows too fast to separate slammed into her back and legs. For a moment her vision went black. She felt herself sliding as the tortoise's main weapon lined up on its target. The movement took her out of the other machine's line of fire, and after a second her vision returned. The arm she held onto, the weapon she was still pushing against, was already pointed at Irene and Alyssa. The humming within it had changed to a chilling whine, and she knew it was about to fire. Screaming her rage and defiance, Penny reversed her push, pulling on the arm instead, wrenching it toward the other tortoise. A heavy clack sounded from the weapon, and the other machine exploded, the force of the blast slamming her back into the tortoise she was wrestling with. Penny fought to hang on. It wasn't over. The enemy machine still had its main and most devastating weapon left, the one she was still gripping. But her body began to fail, her hand growing weak.
Tears of frustration ran from her eyes as she tried desperately to hold on. Then she was falling. More pain blinded her as she struck the ground, insulting bones that were already broken. When she looked up once more, she saw one of the tortoise's legs descending. It had taken the simplest course. It would use its multi-ton weight to crush her. She tried to roll, but her body was no longer responding. And then the tortoise rocked backward as a stone the size of a mule slammed into it. The machine staggered, trying to maintain its balance, but the stone returned, smashing into it once more. It fell. Twisting her neck to the side, Penny could see Irene standing closer now. Alyssa leaned against the slender girl, her arm draped across Irene's shoulder. But Irene didn't seem to notice the other woman's weight. She stood ramrod straight, her eyes blazing as she continued to batter the remaining tortoise with the giant stone. Behind the two women, the side of the keep was shuddering as thousands of stone blocks surrendered to gravity without Irene's power to support them any longer. But Irene no longer cared. Her only focus was the metal colossus in front of her. She kept battering it until the stone she was using shattered, and then she pulled more from the rubble behind her. These were smaller blocks, so she whipped them at it like an angry flock of birds. They were too small to do significant damage, but Irene did not relent, and when the tortoise began trying to regain its footing, she pulled some of the ground away, causing it to sink. It was helpless now, its last weapon ruined, while its body was hopelessly mired in the torn earth. Irene wasn't done, however. Releasing the stones, she tried fire, and when that failed to produce results, she began slamming the downed tortoise with blows of pure force, hammering it until its outer shield began to bend and deform under her assault. Penny could hear her daughter's voice, hoarse from screaming, but she could make out the words, "Don't you dare touch her!" Penny's world faded, and soon all she knew was a throbbing pain, accompanied by the sounds of Irene's fury as she pounded the tortoise. When silence arrived, she thought perhaps she'd passed out, but then she felt soft hands on her.
"Mom, wake up, please!"
Chapter 36. By the time Castle Cameron came into view, the dawn was over and it was well and truly morning, and I was feeling mostly human once more. The sky was clear, so my first sight of it was from more than 10 miles away, too far to see much. At 5 miles, I could tell something had happened, and I used a neat trick I'd learned years back, compressing the air in front of me into a lens to magnify my view. Part of the castle's outer wall was down. The keep was half demolished, and there was smoke rising from several farms nearby. Washbrook itself appeared intact. A glint of sunlight on metal alerted me to the fact that there was something in the wide field that surrounded the castle. Focusing, I spotted the unmistakable form of a tortoise, much like the ones I'd seen near Hallam in Dunbar. But those had been badly damaged, rendered inoperative by the efforts of Graham and Moira. This one was fully functional. As I watched, I saw its upper portion turn and one of its appendages came up. It was aiming at me. My initial thought was that it was ludicrous. I was still roughly 5 miles distant and flying at a good clip. It couldn't possibly hit me. But then again, Gary had been very emphatic when we questioned him about these things and their weapons. What did he call it? I replayed the conversation in my head until the term emerged. A rail gun. Gary had said they fired projectiles at many times the speed of sound and that they were deadly accurate. I changed direction, heading for the ground, and very nearly lost control of my flight. Sudden changes weren't easy when flying at significant speed, but I managed to regain control of myself. I felt something tear through the air above me, moving too fast even for my mage sight to register it. A loud crack echoed in my ears, announcing its passing a split second after the fact. Reducing my speed even further, I continued toward the ground, adding what I hoped was an unpredictable series of lateral movements. I needed to get out of its line of sight before it turned me into a soggy mess of ruined flesh and bloody rain falling toward the earth. The next few seconds were tense, but I was below the tree line before it could fire again. I didn't land, though. Instead, I increased my speed, flying just a few feet above the ground. Normally flying close to the ground was less effort, but not at this velocity. At this speed, I ran the risk of smashing myself into jelly with the slightest mistake. I'd focused the shield around me into the shape of a spear, imbuing it with all the power I could manage, but that was just to protect myself from the flow of air. If I actually made contact with anything solid, I had no doubt it would kill me and almost certainly destroy whatever I hit. With one hand, I reached into my belt pouch and drew out one of my iron bombs. They were simple iron spheres, enchanted and packed with as much power as they could contain without spontaneously detonating.
They were one of my oldest weapons, and over the years they'd been useful on numerous occasions. Because of their explosive nature, they were too dangerous to carry on my person, but the pouch I wore was actually a type of portal that connected to a chest stored in the mountains. I was following the road now, 10 feet above the surface, and the wake of my passage kicked up clouds of dust and shook the trees behind me. I had to increase my altitude as I reached the turn that would take me toward Cameron, since it was simply impossible to make such a turn at my current velocity. I soared over the trees and curved to the left, catching a glimpse of the castle and the tortoise briefly before I was able to complete the turn and drop back down to follow the lane that led homeward. That was more than one tortoise. I'd spotted 3 as I made my turn. Reaching into my pouch, I took out 2 more iron spears so I could adjust my plan. Encasing each iron bomb in its own small arrow-like shield, I extended them outward, pushing them through my own shield. Just the force of the air would set them off if I didn't keep them protected, for I was moving faster than the speed of sound. Then the trees were gone, and the castle loomed before me. One of the machines I'd spotted was directly ahead. I kept one of my iron spears on a direct line toward it as I adjusted my own path upward and to the right. Almost too late, I realized the shield barrier around the castle was active. I was forced to use everything I had to make my upward turn sharper, otherwise I'd obliterate myself against it. I'd only been planning to skim above the castle walls. The first tortoise disintegrated in a showy conflagration of smoke and flame as my body screamed through the air overhead, barely managing to avoid the shield barrier. The other 2 were firing at me with their spinning guns, but my appearance was too sudden for them to aim accurately. Taking advantage of the active shield around the castle, I turned my flight into a looping turn that took me out of their line of fire, flying behind the castle and Washbrook in a long elliptical. That gave me time to examine the damage, and I wasn't pleased. The husks of 2 more tortoises lay dead in the castle courtyard, and it was apparent they'd exacted a terrible toll before they were destroyed. Half of the main keeper collapsed, and the castle wall to the east of the bailey was nothing but rubble. Bodies were everywhere, though I could see people working steadily to line them up in the yard. As I made my circular pass around the castle, I reduced my speed. I couldn't afford to make a mistake and get myself killed, and I was already beginning to tire. The stress of maintaining such a powerful shield and flying at that rate took a lot of power. When I completed my loop and came back around, I was still moving fast, but it was a speed I could survive, something close to the speed of a stooping falcon. I sent my 2 iron bombs ahead of me as the tortoises opened fire on me. The force of their barrage was too much for me and I was forced to land, braking as hard as I could to avoid doing their work for them. One of the iron bombs was struck in midair, exploding before it could reach its target, but the other made it. Lacking the insane speed of my first attack, it didn't destroy the tortoise it hit, but the explosion knocked the machine sideways and did some visible damage to its outer shell. Its companion was slightly closer to me, less than 100 yards away, but still too far for me to do very much damage to it directly with my magic. That was fine for the tortoise, though. It continued to hammer me with fire from its spinning gun. What did Gary call it? A Gatling gun? The attack was so intense it was hard to maintain my shield, and I was almost at the end of my strength. Opening my mind slightly, I called on the earth, feeling its power surge into me from my feet upward. And then I did something unusual, for me at least. I used it to strengthen my body, increasing my speed and physical power. It wasn't something I liked, but my fight with Tyrion had been educational, so I'd done some practicing. Reinforcing my shield, I ran toward the tortoise, chanting in Lycian. The spell I used was the same one I often used to make my hands impervious to fire when dealing with metal in the forge, but this time I included my entire body. There are good reasons not to do that under normal circumstances. The spell essentially caused the flesh to become almost entirely non-conductive to heat, but the skin still radiated heat outward. If done to the entire body, the limbs could slowly freeze while the body's core grew increasingly hot. In short, user beware, proceed with caution. A minute or 2 wouldn't kill me, though. I raced toward the tortoise, altering my personal shield as I ran, until it glowed with an intense heat that thankfully I couldn't feel. It stopped firing, and its torso rotated, bringing its railgun in line with me. Shit, I swore silently. I was still 30 yards away, and from what Moira had described, no shield I could create would be enough to save me if it fired. I zigged to one side, but the weapon tracked me perfectly, so I flung out my power and grappled it directly, forcing it out of line with my body just before it fired. Seconds later, I'd reached it. Matthew and Moira had both told me they were all but invulnerable to ordinary blasts of flame, and even some focused lines of fire, but I was going to put that to the test. The shield around my body was glowing an intense white, and my footsteps had left burning patches of grass behind me. Jumping forward, I gripped one of its massive metal legs in my hands. At that moment, I was strong enough to lift it slightly, forcing the tortoise to adjust its other legs to maintain balance. But other than that, nothing happened. If the machine had been made of iron or steel, it would have begun to smolder and melt beneath my touch already. What the hell is this thing made of? Drawing on the earth, I pumped more heat into my shield, with the exception of the part covering my head, otherwise the glare would have made it impossible to see. Squeezing, I felt the metal under my hands begin to buckle. It collapsed, bent and useless, long before I could melt through it. Shifting my stance, I pushed at the edge of the platform that supported its upper portion and tipped it over. Then I pressed myself against its underside and began to burn my way through. What felt like an eternity passed before the metal began to sag slightly and I was able to dig my fingers in a little, gaining a grip on the smooth surface. Using my now considerable strength, I pulled at it, as though trying to tear the metal apart with brute force. Despite the searing temperature and my strength, I failed. Mostly. Partly I was hampered by the thing's thrashing legs, forcing me to continually wrestle with it to keep it in place. All I'd accomplished was to create a small crack in its underplate. My first instinct was to reach into my pouch and get more of my iron bombs, to shove them through the small opening. But I stopped myself a second later. If I touch them as I am currently, there won't be enough left of me to scrape into a slop bucket. I felt like an idiot. Stupid never dies, I reminded myself, but I'm really putting that motto to the test. My entire strategy had been stupid, using fire and heat when I'd already been warned they were almost useless. Penny must have rubbed off on me over the years. I was being more stubborn than I was smart. I had an opening, though, so I sent a slender lance of fire into it, probing its interior until smoke began to billow outward. An ominous crackle and sizzling white sparks shot out, causing me to back away. Then I ran, cursing my own idiocy. I really am as dumb as I look. A battering ram of air struck my back and tossed me like a leaf through the air as the tortoise exploded. I wound up lying flat on the ground 20 yards away. Miraculously, my shield had weathered the blast and I'd managed the landing without breaking any bones, at least as far as I could tell. My shield was no longer glowing. I'd given up wasting my energy on that fruitless endeavor, but it began to shudder as the other tortoise, which had been circling around its fallen friend, opened fire. Since I hadn't yet anchored myself, my body began sliding across the green turf. The fight had started so well, but now I was getting annoyed. It was time to switch tactics. I'd played around enough, trying things I'd been warned wouldn't work well. Matthew and Moira had both recommended lightning against these things, so I stretched out one hand toward the oncoming machine and sent forth a thundering stroke of actinic blue. The hammering assault on my shield stopped, but the tortoise looked fine. Its weapon spun down, and the other one, the rail gun, began rotating into position. It was 20 yards away, and I didn't think it would miss. For a second, I wished I'd had the foresight to take out my staff earlier. Using it as a rune channel would have made my lightning much more effective. Part of the reason I disliked using lightning was that it was so difficult to control. Unlike fire or pure force, it tended to branch and seek other directions than the user intended for it to take. But it was too late to try and pull my staff out now. Drawing a 6-foot length of wood from a belt pouch was an awkward enterprise under normal conditions. Trying to do so now would just make me a stationary target. So I used an old trick. I drove my will into the ground, flinging a large mass of soil into the air and whipping it into a dirty brown cloud that obscured the space between and around us. Then I got to my feet and leapt into the air. The tortoise fired at some point, but the confusion was enough that it failed to hit me. I'd often heard Cyan warn Penny about jumping during combat, since it robbed the person in the air of their ability to dodge, but that wasn't a rule that really applied to me. Off the ground, I was more mobile than I was on it, and my mage sight enabled me to see the tortoise just as easily as I could have if the dirt cloud hadn't been in the air. Grasping the wind with my power, I guided myself down to hover directly above the tortoise. And then I proceeded to slam successive bolts of pure electric force into it. I continued to move without trouble after the first 2 or 3, raising its railgun toward me, but by the 4th strike, it started to twitch. I didn't stop until it was shaking and smoking, gradually raising my elevation in case this one decided to explode as well. It didn't, which I couldn't help but feel was slightly anticlimactic after all the effort I'd put into it. Oh well. Once it had stopped moving entirely, I glided toward the castle, settling down softly just 20 feet from the shield barrier where the wall had collapsed. A line of people, mostly guardsmen, stood just inside the shield. My fight had attracted a crowd of onlookers. I scanned the crowd, looking for 2 faces in particular, Penny and Irene. I saw neither, and my chest tightened. The destruction of the main keep had my gut twisted into knots. Where were they? Had they retreated to our mountain home? Were they safe? I didn't want to think about the worst case. No, Irene must be alive at least. Someone activated the shield barrier, I thought. I spotted Carl Draper at the front of the crowd, and I called to him through the shield.
Captain Draper, tell Irene to open the shield for me.
He moved as close as he could, since the shield muffled sound slightly.
No one can open it, my lord. We're trapped inside.
That's ridiculous, I protested.
Where's my wife? Where's my daughter?
The guard captain's eyes drifted downward to stare at the ground. Chapter 37.
No, it can't be.
I struggled to restrain myself. I wanted to pound the shield down, but powered by the Godstone, it was impervious to anything I could do.
Lady Irene is tending to the Countess in the barracks,
said Captain Draper after a moment. All the air left my lungs in an explosive sigh of relief. I'd been afraid of the worst.
Your wife was badly wounded in the attack, my lord, but do not think she will survive,
he added. I had an entirely different opinion on the matter, but I had to get inside first.
Why can't Irene lower the shield for me? The control chamber was destroyed during the attack. She has no way to control the enchantment, explained the captain.
Oh, I see, I said, nodding. Well, there was more than one way to skin a cat. Reaching into one of my pouches, I pulled out the cloth stencil for a teleport circle and laid it on the ground. With my Aethar, I burned a temporary circle into the soil and then picked up the cloth and folded it, putting it back in my pouch. With my finger, I burned a new key into the empty section of the circle and then stepped into it. Seconds later, I was inside the transfer house in the castle yard. There was no one there, and when I stepped out, I saw that the rest of the people in the yard were working steadily. Some moved and organized bodies, while others cleared away rubble and stone from the courtyard. They were surprisingly calm. Captain Draper reached me a moment later as I marched toward the building that housed the barracks.
Did you organize all this?
I asked him, impressed by the degree of order they'd achieved so soon after such an enormous disaster.
In part, my lord, as is my duty, said the captain. But I credit most of it to Lady Irene's orders. She's been steady as a rock for us since the attack.
My chest swelled with pride at his words.
Give me a quick summary of what happened, I ordered.
They attacked in the night, began the captain. The outer wall was down and part of the keep was destroyed within seconds. The shield barrier came on moments later, but two of those iron monsters were already inside. They cut our men to ribbons and continued the bombardment of the keep. Everyone inside would probably have died if it weren't for your daughter.
What did she do? I asked, stopping. We were at the door to the barracks, but I wanted to hear the rest before entering.
According to Alyssa, she held the keep up. I don't really know how your magic works, of course, but the walls were collapsing, and then they just stopped. She kept it together for a good long while, until most of the people inside had managed to get out. Those things...
They pointed at the damaged remains of the two tortoises.
We're attacking her the entire time. Then the Countess got here and went after them like a rabid wolf. She managed to injure one and destroy the other. Lady Irene beat the wounded one to death with a rock, from what I'm told. I didn't see that part.
Draper paused before continuing.
But your wife, she was hurt quite badly.
My throat constricted, and I had trouble choking out a response.
Thank you, Captain. Return to your duties. I will check on her.
Then I opened the door and stepped inside the barracks. The interior was well lit, with lanterns glowing. Most of the beds held wounded men, the survivors. As I'd seen, the dead were out in the yard. My youngest daughter was kneeling beside one of the injured, her eyes closed as she turned her attention to things that couldn't be seen with her eyes. She'd almost certainly sensed my entry, but her focus didn't waver. I couldn't fault her dedication, though. Healing was delicate work, and she'd never had any training in it. Irene was still very new to her power. Of course I wanted to interrupt her. I was desperate to see Penny. But rather than spoil her effort, I examined the nearest wounded soldier with my mage sight. It suffered several nasty wounds, and though there was considerably more that could be done to assist him, I was proud of what I found. The skin had been sealed, and while his ribs were still broken, at least one damaged blood vessel had mended. With this many, she didn't have a lot of time to spare, I figured. Still, I was impressed that she'd learned a trick for sealing skin so quickly. Irene had witnessed a lot of my discussions with her older siblings on the topic of wound healing, but she'd never been able to see what we were doing directly, much less practice it. She'd done well with little more than the information gleaned from those lectures. Then I noticed the patient on the next bed over, Alyssa. She was asleep, but a quick sweep of her body told me she had a broken leg and extensive bruising.
"Father,"
came Irene's voice from behind me. I turned to look at her, and it tore at my heart to see her face. In less than 12 hours, my youngest's face had gone from carefree to worn and haunted. She'd been shouldering a tremendous burden by herself, and now her strong veneer was beginning to crack.
"I'm so sorry,"
she added. I wanted to hug her, to let her cry it out, to do what fathers are supposed to do, make everything better. But I needed her strength still. "Don't be sorry," I replied. "You did more than anyone could expect. Bear it a while longer." Her lip quivered a second, but then it firmed up, and I embraced her. She squeezed me tightly and spoke into my chest.
"But, Mum..."
I cut her off before the words could undo her. "Take me to her." Penny was in Captain Draper's private room, covered by a thick wool blanket. Her armor and clothing had been removed, and my mage sight found no breaks or recent cuts to her skin. I glanced ruefully at the enchanted mail that lay across the nearby chair. It had done its job, nothing had penetrated. But once again, that hadn't been sufficient. My wife lay on her belly, and when I drew the blanket back, I hissed at the sight. Most of the visible skin was black or red. Massive hematomas had formed beneath the skin. She looked as though someone had tied her down and beaten her with a small sledge. Beneath the skin, things were worse. Some of the vertebrae had been shattered, and the ribs near them broken. Her kidneys were beyond help, and all the other soft tissues were similarly ruined. If she'd been conscious, she would have been in incredible pain, assuming she could feel anything. The damage to her spine meant she was likely paralyzed. It was a miracle she was still alive.
"I didn't know what to do,"
said Irene softly, her voice filled with guilt.
"Can you... you can heal her, right?"
My youngest was close to dissolving into tears, and I couldn't blame her. I felt the same, but I pushed those feelings down deep. Neither of us could afford to give in to our emotions. Not yet. What should I say, though? "There's nothing you could have done," I thought. "This is beyond anything normal wizardry can heal." If it had been anyone else, I would have just told her it was hopeless, that the best thing to do would be to ease their passing. But this wasn't anyone else. This was Penny. This was my Penny. I couldn't accept that answer, and if I said those words to Irene, neither of us would be able to do the things we needed to do. "She'll be fine," I said with a confidence I didn't feel. "Give me a few hours. I can fix this. Don't worry."
"Dad, this is my fault," said Irene.
"Shh, don't blame yourself. This is life. None of us are perfect. If you start taking the blame for every tragic thing that happens, you'll never be able to move forward. Give me some time with her. Don't let anyone in until I open the door. Do you understand?" My daughter nodded, blinking back more tears. "You've done well. I couldn't be prouder of you," I added. "Go back out there and keep doing what you've done so far. Show them your strength. This is the burden we bear for the people we serve. Right now, it's just you and me, so you'll have to handle everything while I help your mum. Can you do that?" Irene stood with her head bowed, struggling to contain it all. Her shoulders shook slightly. But then she lifted her face and rubbed her cheeks.
"Yes, Father."
Then she left, closing the door gently behind her. I put the bar in place once the door closed, and then I used a quick spell to lock the latch in place as well. I didn't want any interruptions. With a few more words and a bit of aether, I put a privacy ward around the room to prevent Irene or any of my other children, should they return, from seeing what I was doing. Moving to the bedside, I removed the blanket and then used my power to gently lift Penny's body, sliding it to one side, making enough room for me to lie beside her. As careful as I was, she still felt it, and a low moan rose from her lips. Her eyes opened, fixing on me, piercing my heart. She tried to speak, but only managed a few hoarse grunts. "Don't try to talk," I told her, trying to keep my face calm. I was removing my own clothes. Strictly speaking, neither of us needed to be nude, but it simplified things slightly. After a few minutes, I finished and climbed carefully into the bed next to her. With our faces only inches apart, I gazed into the warm brown depths of her eyes. "I should have been here," I said.
But you did the impossible without me as usual. You're an incredible woman, Penny. I hope you know how much I love you. Then I leaned forward and kissed her lips, linking our minds as we touched.
Is Irene all right?
I should have known her first thought would be for her children. The knowledge sent a feeling of warmth through me. She's fine, I told her. A little scared, but she has your strength. She's taking care of things while I take care of you.
What about the others?
She asked. They haven't returned yet, but I believe they'll be all right, I answered. I would have lied, but doing so while directly linked wasn't easy, so I stuck to the truth. You should be more worried about yourself.
Am I dying?
Despite her courage, I could feel the faint undercurrent of fear at the thought. It wasn't a fear of oblivion, though, but rather the fear of being separated from our loved ones. Yes, I answered, but we can fix this. Do you trust me?
No.
I frowned mentally, but then she added,
I trust you will do whatever it takes for my sake. I don't trust that you won't hurt yourself trying.
Well, this will be risky. This is what I talked to you about before, a way to completely heal your body. Knowing how you felt, I decided not to do it, which is why I worked so hard to make that artificial arm for you. But now this is the only way.
Then don't do it. Let me go,
she told me emphatically. I can't do that.
Yes, you can. I love you, Mort, but our children depend on you. This is a selfish risk.
Sorry, I replied. I'm selfish, I'll admit it. I can't live without you, and our children need you as much or more than they do me.
Mordecai!
I flinched inwardly at the strength of her disapproval, but I went on. Listen, this isn't as bad as it sounds. You'll be the one making the decisions, so I need to explain as much as I can before I hand the reins over.
What does that mean?
Our consciousnesses will merge, and then we will become you. My awareness will vanish temporarily, since only you can restore your body this way. You'll be the one in control, but you'll have my power.
I don't know how to use it. This isn't going to work, Mort. It's foolish,
she replied, with rising panic in her thoughts. Stay calm, I replied. It's not a matter of knowledge. This isn't like wizardry. It's more instinctive. I'll explain the main points so you'll understand what you see and what to do.
And if I refuse?
You can't, I told her stubbornly. Once I hand over control, you can do whatever you want. But if you don't take care of things, one or both of us will die.
This isn't fair.
It never is, I replied. Once we merge, you'll feel as though you're falling asleep. But when you wake up, you will be alone, in a bed with two bodies, yours and mine. They're both alive, for now, and you'll see something like a flame within each of them. That's called the Aestrilin. It's the seat of life. In a sense, it's your soul, and it has to keep burning or else you'll die. The power you'll be using will come from mine, but you need to keep your awareness inside your own body. Imagine yourself as you were, I continued, as you were before you were hurt. You'll be able to reimagine your body, and if you're good enough, you can remember the arm you lost too. Once that's finished, you will have to think of me. Release the power and think of me. This will be the hardest part, because it will require you to think of yourself becoming me while at the same time releasing your link to my body. If you do it right, we'll both wake up. She was afraid, and I couldn't blame her.
And if I do it wrong?
Then one of us won't wake up. Probably me. You'll be alone with a dead body in the bed next to you. On the plus side, you'd also be a pretty badass wizard and archmage.
I don't want to do this, she protested.
I love you, I said. And then I opened my mind, listening to the universe. The wind thrummed in the sky above, the earth thumped like a giant drum deep below, and beside me, a beautiful woman slowly died. I listened to her flesh when I dreamed of her heart, the greatest gift I'd ever received in this world. Softly, I faded away. Chapter 38. Penny woke. Or perhaps she dreamed. She wasn't really sure. The world was strange and new, and much of what she saw was hard to understand. It felt as though she was floating, suspended in a cloud.
Her vision extended in every direction, filling her mind with the contents of the entire room. What held her attention, however, were the two bodies that lay below her, Mordecai's and her own. As he had said, both contained a burning spark, but the similarities ended there. The bodies, of course, were very different. His was heavier, more muscular, and near perfect health, while hers was on the verge of death. What disturbed her was the flames within each of them. While Mort's burned like a blaze with searing intensity, hers was a tiny ember about to go out.
I don't have much time, she thought.
Pushing her fear aside, she got to work. With a thought, she flowed into her body, and then she set about building the mental image she desired. When Mordecai had described it, she thought it would be impossible, but her mental imagery was different now. She couldn't explain it in words, but her mind was able to create visions that were so finely detailed that it surprised her.
Is this what it's like for him? She wondered.
She knew from past discussions that her husband's mind worked a little differently from most, but she hadn't expected it to be like this.
Everything is so sharp, so clear.
For a moment she was envious. What would it be like to live with such vivid imagery inside your head every day?
Wait, does this mean I'm me, or am I him?
She felt like herself, but the difference in her mindscape was an obvious reminder.
This is so strange. I know I'm myself, and yet I must have been him before.
She pushed those thoughts aside.
Remember my body, the body I had, then make it real.
The flesh blurred, flowing into its old shape. Penny marveled at how simple it had been.
So much power, and he lives with this every day. I'd probably go mad.
And she withdrew, gazing down on their two bodies from a short distance above them. As expected, her body seemed perfect, but the flame within was unchanged. It was dying. She thought that might be because of the injuries, but obviously that wasn't the case.
Was this why he didn't want to do this? Was he afraid I would see how little is left?
Somewhere deep down, she felt the truth. Repairing her body had been nothing. It was her astralin that was the problem, and he hadn't known of a way to fix that.
I'm about to die anyway.
Once more, she looked at his astralin to compare them. There was something wrong with his as well. It burned fiercely, but as she looked closer, she found cracks, dark veins of something other between the filaments of living aether. For all the power it represented, the seat of her husband's soul was sick.
Parts of it are foreign, grafted on by those strange dark roots.
She was afraid of what it might represent. Was it a side effect of his time as a Shigreth, or a result of his strange transformation during the fight with the Ungol? Penny had no way of knowing, but either way it didn't bode well for him. She spent some time studying it, before eventually an idea came to her.
He's not going to like this. But then again, he didn't give me a choice either.
Diving down, she filled her body again, sitting up and marveling at her perfect health. Stretching her left arm out, she examined her hand, fascinated by its perfection. She wished she could have longer to enjoy it. Penny got to her feet and picked up the blanket, wrapping it around her naked form. Then she went to the door. With a thought, she removed the spell locking it, simultaneously dissolving the privacy ward that covered the room. Then she picked up the bar and opened it, stepping out into the barracks. There were beds full of wounded men everywhere, but Penny had eyes for one person only, Irene. Her daughter had been bending over one of the men, but she straightened up to look at her mother immediately, her eyes growing wide.
"Mum!"
exclaimed Irene, but then her expression changed to one of confusion.
"Mum, come here,"
said Penny, and as soon as the girl was close enough, she pulled her into a tight embrace.
"I love you, Rennie. Always remember that."
"He really did it,"
mumbled Irene.
"But how? And what's wrong with your aether? It doesn't feel right. I thought you were dead for a minute. Is this an illusion?"
Penny shook her head.
"No, it's not an illusion. It's me. And yes, he did it. But there are problems. Your father is resting at the moment. Can you send for some writing materials?"
"Why?"
asked Irene suspiciously. And then Penny began to explain, holding nothing back. She needed Irene's full cooperation, otherwise things would be too difficult, and she didn't have that much time. My youngest began crying after the first two sentences, and they were both a wretched mess of tears by the time she was done. Captain Draper appeared at some point, but neither of them paid any attention to him or the other onlookers. Penny clung to her daughter as long as she could, but when the servant returned with what she'd requested, she began to untangle herself.
"Mom, no, please,"
begged Irene.